for it at 1 hour and 15 minutes. And granted, 10 of that is shit I'm going to cut from my synopsis. but still...
Welcome back to Snark Squad Pod. My name is Marines.
I am Nicole Sweeney, and this week we are joined by Connor.
Hey, what's up, you guys? I'm Connor. I run a BookTube channel, which is just Connor O'Brien, where I primarily talk about fantasy and science fiction.
And Connor is back with us once again to talk about the third and final book in the His Dark Materials trilogy, The Amber Spyglass. This book being the final book in a fantasy series, there's a lot going on here, and it's now my job to do the plot synopsis. Bear with me. So this book finds, you know, our characters spread out across many of the different worlds in this universe. There's lots of competing plot threads, and this is also the point where we get a clearer understanding of some of the, I don't know, political machinations of the adult world. And so I think I'm going to start there just to make it easier to tell the kids' story. This is definitely the least interesting part of this book, but I think it'll be easier to work through the kids' threads if I start with this. So Lord Asriel's like whole plot, as we learn in this book, is that he wants to take down the authority, which in this universe, basically God was the first angel, and then like told the rest of the angels that he made them because he was there first. Asriel like marshals forces from many different worlds, and then they start building a Republic of Heaven in what was a previously unoccupied world. This is all really just background and matters mostly because we meet some of the beings from different worlds in this sort of like blank slate new place. And like these other beings kind of show up throughout Will and Lyra's journey. The forces of the Magisterium and the Church, meanwhile, have figured out that Lyra is supposed to be Eve, and they decide that the easiest solution to their problem is to just kill this child before she can be tempted, including dispatching a priest who is sent to follow Mary in case all of their other efforts to kill one child fail. Asriel mostly seems interested in protecting Lyra because the Church wants to kill her and not because she's his daughter, because he's an asshole. Lyra, beginning of this book, having been abducted at the end of the Subtle Knife, is being kept hostage and in a drugged sleep in a cave in the mountains by Mrs. Coulter. While she's asleep, we see her between chapters in these interstitial segments conversing with a deceased Roger in a sort of bleak place that we eventually learn is the Land of the Dead. After ending the last book with the dramatic sequence of meeting his father only to watch him die and then returning to Lyra only to have her be abducted, Will meets two angels who insist that they followed his father in order to reach the knife bearer and then, help complete John Perry's mission of getting the knife to Asriel. But Will is not interested in any of that because he needs to go find Lyra. And he's basically like, look, I'm not going with you. And, you know, there's nothing really for you to do besides help me or like shut up. So the angels are forced to help Will on his mission, which eventually takes him into Lyra's world because that's where she's being held, and into contact with Yorick. They travel for a bit. Yorick helps Will find Lyra and rescue her. And then while he and Lyra are fleeing from Mrs. Coulter, and also like a whole bunch of armies of like both the Church and Lord Asriel's army also show up, all trying to get Lyra, but they get away, but Will breaks the knife in the process. And fortunately, they have found Yorick recently, so they're able to kind of go hide out with Yorick and rebuild the knife. Somewhere in here, we meet the Galavespians, who are people from another world entirely, and they're very small, and they have these little dragonflies that they ride around on, and they're pretty dope, little spies. They're I don't really know. I was like, that's it. There's these two little spies, and they are also trying to make Will and Lyra go off with Lord Asriel, but Lyra, when she's awake, is committed to going to find Roger because she promised him during the, you know, during her sort of dream state that she was definitely going to believe that this was real when she woke up, and she was going to come help him because she has to go make it right because it was her fault, more or less. I mean, she brought him to his death and she feels responsible. So she wants to go make that right. And Will wants to, you know, to see if he can go find his father. So they're adamant about using the knife to find their way down to the land of the dead. And the Galavespians, much like the angels, are forced to just go with them. Oh yeah, the angels, one of the angels died at some earlier, and the other one fled during the fighting by the cave. So angels are no more in their place. We now have the Galavespians. Lyra and Will make their way to the land of the dead. They create an opening so that ghosts can forevermore like be freed from the land of the dead. And they sort of will drift out and become kind of part of everything once they leave the land of the dead. Some of the ghosts hang back, and Will cuts an opening into this other dimension world, whatever, where Azrael is, and those ghosts kind of go and join the fight there because they can contend with the specters. Lyra and Will also go out into that world where all this fighting is happening in order to reclaim their demons. Azrael and Mrs. Coulter do one good thing to help their daughter and die in the process. meanwhile, while all of this has been going on, Mary's been off on her own wild side quest in this whole other world. And basically the point of her side quest is that she is learning about the nature of dust. That kind of was always her jam. But she put some pieces together that ultimately amount to the like dust is leaving the universe, and it was caused mostly by the knife, which is cutting all of these openings between the world. But every time an opening is cut, a specter was created, which is why the world where the knife was created, that world was full of specters. And also each opening was like causing dust to leach out of the universe because people, we're traveling between the worlds. And so the book describes this basically as like tossing a pebble into a river to like redivert the stream. But Will and Lyra like fall in love in the land where Mary is. They eventually make their way back to her. How is not really important. And that causes the dust to like have something new to latch onto. And it stops the like torrent of dust out of the world. However, all of these holes, all of the openings created by the knife still need to be closed in order to stop this from happening long term. Also, Will's dad, who they encounter in the Land of the Dead, informs them that like the reason that he was dying already, he was a very, very sick man because his demon couldn't thrive out of the world where he belonged. And so the point of all of this is that Will and Lyra are not going to be able to stay together because they have to close all of the openings except for the one that allows the ghosts to leave the land of the dead. And they can't keep using the knife because every time they use it, a specter is created and so on and so forth. And angels are going to help close up all the openings, but like ultimately Will and Lyra have to go back to their own worlds. And this is very sad for them, but that is basically the point, is that everybody has to go back to where they belong and make the Republic of Heaven, everybody in all of their own different worlds. I did my best, you guys.
We appreciate you.
Yes.
For those of you listening at home, there's like 10 extra minutes I had to cut out. I hope it made sense.
Well, attack a lot of these threads kind of individually, I'm sure. But for now, we're going to start where we always start and ask, did you like it? So, Connor, did you like this last book in the series?
I just finished it today, actually.
Classic.
Always waiting until the last minute to finish things. I did enjoy it. I think that because I read this so quickly in like such a short span of time, I thought that there was going to be like a bigger finale, but it had like a more quiet ending that was just like sad. I do. I think that I really enjoyed the new things, like the, oh my gosh, I forgot the name, the small humans. What are their names? Galavespians.
The Galavespians. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I really liked their addition. I liked their take on the world. I think I liked all of the different peoples that we met, and they all have a different view of like dust and what should happen and everything like that. So I really liked seeing everyone's viewpoint on this same subject, but then they all kind of align in the end. So yeah, I enjoyed it.
Nicole, I'm dying to know, did you like this book?
Shocking no one. I love this book. This is actually my favorite of the three books. I think, like, story-wise, I understand why the first book is most people's favorite, but I fucking love The Land of the Dead. I just like the whole, I love, I don't know, just like that it exists, like as a like plot premise, and everything about what happens, what that means for Lyra's character development. I love it so much. I also love, like Connor mentioned, all sort of the other peoples that we meet. The Mulefa are super cool. All of that is great. I love The Land of the Dead more than pretty much anything else in this entire series.
This was my second time reading this book. And first time through, I'm one of those people that like the first one is my favorite. And by the time I got to the third one, I was like, I liked it, but I wasn't completely sold on it. And in rereading, I know why. I can really pinpoint why this book does not deliver for me as much as the first or the second one. But again, I love these characters so much, and I love the world building, and I love those elements. To me, it's more the plot and the themes that always miss a little bit for me, making this kind of a mixed bag. Although my love for like Lyra and Will and, you know, Yorick and all of the characters that we see come back is stronger than like the bad things. So while this one is not my favorite, I have an overall positive experience with it, but I do have some issues with some of the pieces. So I guess that on that note, Connor, I'm curious for you, compared to the two other books, do you have a favorite? How does this one like rank?
I think that, like you said, I think that the first one ended up being my favorite, but that's just my like personal preference. I love the like adventure, like going to save my best friend kind of thing. And then I was totally blindsided at the end of the first book when her best friend ends up dying. I liked the plot of that one probably the most. I really got invested in the like bigger picture of the world in the second one. And I kind of have a similar thought process to you, Madi, about this one, where I don't think that everything comes together like as good as it could have, but I still enjoyed it. I think it's like this. I like the first one the best, the second one, and then I don't know. I don't know if I like the second one or not. I'm trying to think of the cutoff.
We are on the record all the time as talking about how much we hate ranking things. So like the fact that she just put you in this position on the spot is like low-key fucked up, but
I guess I'm also having a hard time remembering where the second book ends and this one begins.
Yes, yes. They all blur together for me as well.
Yeah. Yes.
These are kind of like equal in my mind. The first one is my favorite, though.
And then it's like one and two, three. That's a good answer. All right. So let's bring it back around to Lyra and Will and their journey. And, you know, the kind of, they start apart and then they get reunited and then they hatch up the scheme to go to the Land of the Dead, which we've already heard is part of what Nicole loves about this book. So how'd you feel about their journey overall? Yeah, that's my question.
I think that this one, they travel to a lot of places, which I think is like one of the big points of this, is you get to meet all these different peoples, and there's like a long journey of jumping from one world to another and like jumping between worlds to avoid certain situations. I think that we could have gotten to the ending a little quicker than we did, but I didn't hate it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I'm like scrolling through my like highlights and stuff, because it got to a point where I just kept highlighting different passages that were like very big essential coming of age theme moments. Like, this is the third book in the series. This is, you know, the point where they're bringing things around. And there is a ton of stuff with Will and Lyra being forced to really do things on their own in this book. Like, they continue to have help. You know, first Will has, you know, angels, and then eventually the Galavespians. But more and more, you see them realizing the degree to which they have to rely on themselves. I really love that piece of it. I also just, we learned that Lyra found out that there was some big prophecy about her, but that she couldn't know that she was supposed to do something. So she made a point of sort of like trying to forget, and she never asked the alethiometer about it. But she decided that like this whole thing, going to the Land of the Dead, was like that was going to be the thing. She decided for herself this thing, which is, I don't know, in my opinion, like the biggest thing that anybody does in, like, she changes the nature of death, like this little girl does. And so, like, and this is just a thing that she chose to do on her own because she wanted to make something right. And I think that that is, like, really cool and powerful and, like, awesome. That is a choice that she made for herself, and a choice. So much of her story is you know, about her being like a chosen one and her being the product of like, you know, prophecies and different people reacting to the prophecies and, you know, like bigger questions about how much are people furthering her along and getting to that fate, right? By like the ways in which you resist it or don't and all of that. But this was like her making a choice and a like really big one. And I don't know. I really love watching Lyra and Will come into their own in this book.
I agree with that. And I think that a big part of why I do enjoy their journey in this book is the way that it kind of is cyclical. And thinking back to like book one, when Lyra leads Roger to her death, and then in this one, she ends up going back for Roger, and how that kind of closes the circle. And, you know, and you see in like book one that she almost gets separated from Pan, and that's like a big emotional crux in the first book. And in this book, she does end up having to leave Pan. And so there are a lot of things like that, that like her journey really does come full circle that I really appreciated. And then it comes full circle with that idea of they're constantly saying like, we have help, but we can't rely on anybody but ourselves, which you mentioned. And so the way that even with the little spies with them, they keep telling them like, you can leave. We're still going to do this, basically.
Right.
So the way that, you know, that whole like journey really is just relying on themselves and what they decided to do and what felt right. And I love that she really does have like the biggest impact on the story. She does change the nature of death, but it came from a place of, I want to say sorry to my friend for something bad,
yes,
that I did to him. And it,
yes,
was like, and the, that's how the whole thing started. Just, it was not like some big adventure. It was not like, it'd be cool to see the, you know, the land of the dead. It wasn't even like, I want to save Roger necessarily. Like her primary motivation was, I led him to his death. I need to go back and make it right and say sorry.
And this idea of it's the right thing to do. Like,
right.
And this is, this is also a big thing in Lyra's journey. Like, you know, at the beginning of the book, that's not something that Lyra is particularly concerned with at the beginning of the first book, you know? Like, Lyra is a lot of things. She's not, like, you know, a malicious child, but this idea of what's right is, like, it's, honestly, it's something that she kind of learns from Will. Like, Will is very fixated on this idea of doing the right thing in a way that Lyra never was. And so, like, the fact that her big act ultimately is, I have to do this because it's the right thing to do. And, like, I am, you know, coming of age, I am learning that, like, it matters to me to do the right thing. Like, I don't know. That's just really sweet.
Yeah, I mean, there was also the opportunity where the witch, is it Serafina that tells them this? No, it's the angel, right? The female angel? I don't remember. But where they say that one, like, portal or gateway could be left open, and Lyra's like, no, we can't have one where we can see each other. It has to stay the one that's in the land of the dead, or else everything was for nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. I really like that. I also really like that you brought up the whole prophecy thing. It definitely is like one of those coming of age things where like everyone has their own plan for Lyra. Like everyone has their own thing that they want her to accomplish, and like they want her to fulfill this prophecy in a specific way. So they're all trying to like mold her and shape her. And then in the end, she's like, no, I'm doing this instead. So that's like just how normal kids are. Like their parents and everyone is trying to like push them in different directions, and then at the end of the day it's like, no, this is what I'm doing in my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To this thing of like the, as Will and Lyra are going on their big, you know, this conclusion to their coming of age journey and like, you know, learning to act in new ways, one of the things that I highlighted is the moment where Will keeps from Lyra the fact that Mrs. Coulter was drugging her asleep, I thought was really interesting, in part because like the contrast between the two of them is that like Lyra's the one who lies, and this is very clearly framed framed as a lie of omission, but like he's also making the choice that, you know, not to betray this one sweet memory that Lyra has of her mother taking care of her. I also thought that was really interesting, just like the moral complexity that they are coming into. Like that's this particular coming of age moment, you know, leaving childhood and entering adolescence, part of what that entails is coming into a sense of moral complexity. And this is just, I don't know, it was a like sweet little moment of Will grasping that in a new way.
I think that you definitely see Lyra leaning more towards the white in her gray area, and Will leaning more towards the black.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of like, you know, not only is like the lies of omission, and there are, it's weird because I think if I recall correctly, there are several times that Lyra's like, Will's not a good liar in the story, but we see him lie a couple times, and you're like, I don't know, he's getting pretty good.
Yes.
But also, Will kills a few people,
right?
And it's always in like self defense. Or, you know, it's not like cold-blooded murder or anything like that. And he has like very visceral reactions, and he talks a lot about like, this is not what he wants to be doing. But also that like grays his story.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, when we meet Will, he is very staunchly aware of what is right, what he needs to be doing. He's full of responsibility just because of how he was brought up. And you see him, like I said, kind of graying out the same way that Lyra is.
I think also with Will, you also see him start to use his, like, I guess in the book they kind of describe it as like some special ability to like go unnoticed, and he even does that towards like the beginning of this one when he first encounters Yorick and he challenges Yorick, and then after that's over he like uses his ability to go unnoticed and the townspeople leave him alone. But he stops using that, I think, after that point, and like he is a lot more okay with, you know, standing up for himself and for people noticing him. So I think that was really well done, because it like completely went along with all of his other changes.
I think this book also starts to, or at least tries to, so I'm curious how you guys feel about this, but it starts to complicate a little bit their views of their parents, I think. I think especially Mrs. Coulter starts like, I don't know, she's like, all of a sudden she wants to be a mom. There's literally a passage, and you're led to believe that she's kind of like lying and manipulating as she's saying this, but she's literally like, I didn't want to be a mom, and then 12 years later I remembered I had a child. And then lying is all I think about. And even in like Will's thinking of his own mom, and you know, he has like a line where, you know, it isn't fair that he has to go back and take care of his mom, but it's a different kind of not fair. It's like not nobody's at fault, and it's just something he has to do. So how did you feel about Lord Asriel, about Mrs. Coulter, like all of the parent stuff in this one?
I mostly like the journey that Mrs. Coulter goes on. I think when I think about it in the abstract, I have weird feelings about it, but the way that it is dealt with feels plausible to me. Like it's coming into contact with Lyra that changes things for Mrs. Coulter. Like she meets her, and we see so many people throughout the series like meet this ferocious little girl and, you know, be influenced by her in this way. And so for Mrs. Coulter to meet her and also, you know that this is her daughter, I think all of that comes together in a way that makes a kind of sense, that like that it's complicated for her, and even her way of dealing with it, right? Like that, you know, she wants to protect her, and so she drugs her, is still, you know, it's not like like Mrs. Coulter is a complicated character. Even when she is trying to quote unquote do right by her daughter, she does it, you know, within the scope of being being a like nefarious character. And so I don't think that she is suddenly turned into this, you know, sweet and doting woman. Like, she's still incredibly manipulative. All of that is still there. She just also, you know, cares a lot about Lyra and, like, is conflicted about it. So that all tracks. I continue to think that Lord Asriel is like a bad person.
Worst. He's the worst.
But I also, like, I think he's a bad person, but, like, This is the book. It actually makes a little bit more sense to me in reading this book. And I don't know how much of this is affected by watching the new trailer that just came out, that like that also kind of for the upcoming BBC HBO adaptation, but that like colored some of this. But I have a better grasp on like the idea of Asriel as this whatever, like charismatic leader of rebellion, but who is like really shitty in his personal life. And like this all tracks with that, but like he sucks. Like he's not the like even his one. He finally recognizes how dope Lyra is, and it's like, wow, imagine that. He's like one passage where he's, you know, it suddenly dawns on him that this little girl is cool as hell, and but other than that, he like doesn't really care, and he's constantly dismissive of her, and he sucks.
I agree. Lord Asriel is the worst.
I can't remember like the meme word for word, but there's some meme that is like the tigers eating people party is upset that tigers have eaten them kind of thing, to like kind of talk about people who subscribe to certain political beliefs or whatever, and how you can kind of be removed from that until it affects you personally, and then when it does affect you personally, you know, that idea of being like, what? And that's Mrs. Coulter to me, where like she was, you know, separating kids from their demons, but it all became like shockingly real when it was Lyra in the cage or whatnot. Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. You know, she was all in for the church murdering whoever to like get to their end or whatever. But when it was Lyra who they were going to murder, she was like, not my baby. And she drugged her and put her in a cave. So yeah, that kind of, and I think that kind of like blind loyalty to organized religion or any kind of organization is a big part of what the story is trying to like navigate and explore. Mm-hmm. So I think that you're supposed to feel very complicated to her about her, but yeah, I think she mostly sucks, and Lord Asriel is the worst. That's my feelings.
I think with Mrs. Coulter, it's a little bit more complicated than just a flat unthinking loyalty either, because for her it was mostly ambitious, right? Like mm-hmm. Her devotion to the cause, to me at least, always read as being first and foremost about being the way in which she could climb in, like, Lyra's world is much more patriarchal and in nature, you know, like Lyra early on is like, you know, thinks of the idea of female scholars as being silly because it, you know, that's just like, that is the nature of it. And so Mrs. Coulter kind of viewed the church as a place in which she might still be able to climb and like that first and foremost. But I don't know. I think there's a lot that is interesting about this character. And that's something that I am curious to see the adaptation handle, because obviously this character is, you know, she exists only re-Lyra in the confines of the books, but I am curious to see how the show handles her.
I think also just like what Madi said with how like you can kind of separate yourself from some of the terrible things that are happening until they affect you directly. And I said this in the first part, but I think that Mrs. Coulter and Lyra are so similar to each other. Like they both, until Lyra starts having to tell the truth with the harpies, like they have both gotten by with manipulating and lying and everything like that. And I think it's funny too, because Lyra has this ability, or not even ability, just like everyone just wants to help her. like everyone does. And that's kind of how Miss Coulter is as well. When people meet her, they immediately want to like help her and be on her side. Like when Will meets Mrs. Coulter, he like is enamored by her and like mm-hmm. wants to believe the best in her. And that's what happens with Lyra throughout the course of the story as well. But I do think that she overall still really sucks. like at one point, I think it's either an angel or someone like that calls her a cesspit. Oh wait, it's the
Metatron.
Calls her a cesspit of model filth. And I was like, dang, yes, that's what you are.
It's true.
And I also think that it's interesting because she had this shift, this big shift when Lyra went into the cage and it was going to be her daughter and it was going to affect her. And then we find Miss Coulter in this book in the cage herself, and she's about to have her demons stripped away and everything like that.
And I love the moment that she has of like recognizing that irony too. She's like, damn. y'all about to kill my daughter with a machine that like that was my idea. I also really love that point that you were making too, though, about the similarities between Lyra and Mrs. Coulter. That like we see in Lyra a somewhat more innocent form of that charisma, and then you know Mrs. Coulter represents a direction that that can take in malicious hands, you know, like with here is one way that somebody with that kind of natural charm and charisma can wind up. And the lying is super interesting too, because Will has a thought. Will goes to meet Mrs. Coulter in the cave before he goes to actually like free Lyra, and they have a brief conversation, and then he gets back to the Galavespians and Yorick and the Angel at this point in time is pre-Galavespians, but he gets back, he's you know trying to make sense of what he's learned from Mrs. Coulter, and he says she'd lie even if it made things worse for herself because she just loves lying too much to stop. And it's hilarious for him to be saying this as a criticism of Mrs. Coulter as he is desperately trying to free Lyra. who he adores and can find no fault in. So I just, yeah.
I think this book subtly shows you the big difference between like Lyra's charisma and Mrs. Coulter's charisma, and the way that the people that want to help Lyra then start forming this part of like her extended family. Like she, you know, her charisma is used in a way that attracts people to her, but she's also then good to the people around her. So that by the time that she's like hugging Yorick and like, I don't know, high-fiving Lee Scoresby in the Land of the Dead, and like you really, and Serafina Pecola is coming to her to talk to her demon. You really start to get a grasp of all of the people that she surrounded herself with, mm-hmm. and the way that it has not been like manipulation for the sake of like stepping on people to get to where she's going, but really building this family around her.
Mm-hmm. I love that we like there's actual conversation around Mrs. Coulter, who is framed as openly malicious for really, you know, the bulk of the series, and like the closest she gets to redemption is her kind of complicated choices in this final book, and but like there's stuff to talk about with her, whereas we're all just like Lord Asriel sucks. The end.
It's still the wildest thing because he is constantly painted as being like on the side, the good side,
right?
And I can't take it seriously. I can't, because I hate him so much. And every time he's like, he had this one, he's thinking about Lyra, and she's like, but he's basically thinking like, she's no big deal. I have no idea why anybody is paying this much attention to her. And I'm just like, oh, fuck you. I don't care what side you're on.
But I also think to some degree that's part of the point. I mean, on some level, I do think that Pullman's perspective is that Asriel is a better person than he actually is. I talked about this last time, whatever. But I mean, in what is, you know, one of several like major, you know, thesis moments in the book, Mary explains that part of why she stopped being a nun is that she, quote, stopped believing that there was a power of good and a power of evil that were outside of us, and came to believe that good and evil were names for what people do, not for what they are. It's like categorizations for actions rather than people. And so like the idea that the people on both sides are complicated, I think I think that there could be more layers to that than there are in the book, but I think that that is very much the point, that like, it, you know, no one individual person is meant to be entirely good or bad.
You mentioned Mary, so I want to turn to her now, because I know in previous episodes we've kind of talked of like, wait till we get to Mary's story in the third book, mostly because I found it so boring the first time that I originally read it. And I don't know, we kind of foreshadowed that maybe that would change on reread. But Connor, I'm curious, how did you like Mary's portion of the story?
I was really thinking that she was gonna do more. just because the like angels, whoever sending her all the messages, was really adamant that she needs to get out of her world now and into this world now, and was really pushing her forward. So I was really excited at the end of the second book about what she was all gonna like have going on. And then she gets to the Mulefa and then just sits there for I don't even know how long. And I did like the Mulefa, because we get another viewpoint on the dust and everything that's happening, and how the dust enables their trees to grow, and it like is the I don't know, the life force of the Mulatha because they need the oil, everything like that. But Mary herself doesn't really do all that much. And I was sad because I feel like she had so much potential that she could be like a big active player. But then again, if she took a more active role in like the overall plot of this story, it wouldn't be Will and Lyra doing stuff on their own. So it's kind of like a pro and a con. But I do wish that she had done more than just kind of like insert herself into this like deer / car society.
Connor, you're welcome to have these opinions about Mary, but you're like wrong. I don't know. I love everything that Mary does, like her whole little side quest. I adore it. I love it for the way that it fleshes out the world. I appreciate the function that it serves in the larger story. I also really love, I mentioned last time that the US titles of the three books are effectively like the three totem objects of the three, you know, biggest characters in the series. So the first book is named after Lyra's object, second book is named after Will's object, and the third is named after Mary's. And I think it's interesting that, and we had kind of a whole little conversation about this on the Discord, but I think it's really interesting that Mary creates her object, whereas Lyra and Will were effectively chosen for their objects. And like, it makes sense because they are kind of, they're both children and they're chosen ones, whereas Mary's whole jam is, you know, knowledge. You know, she represents the serpent, like that's her whole, like her function in this story. And also she's actually an adult having this kind of, you know, belated second, third, what have you, coming of age moment. But the agency of the fact that she is the one who makes the Amber Spyglass, I don't know, something about that I just find metaphorically so, so cool. And like her whole side quest is just about learning shit, and I love it so much.
I'm probably in between you two. I can like intellectually stand back and see how Mary's side quest about learning things and discovering and like being there when the children need her, like that's cool. But in while reading, I wasn't always like super hyped to get back to her like climbing trees and looking up at the sky and stuff, like just for like the sake of like the plot and the forward motion. Like those moments were a little slower to me in retrospect. Yes, everything Nicole is saying is also correct, but yeah. I also like, I thought that I would love it a little bit more, and I agree that I thought that like she would do a little more. But yeah, her whole jam was literally just like discovery in the middle of all of this other action. Like you took pauses to visit with Mary and learn what she was discovering. I think that probably the story is hurt a little bit by the fact that what she's discovering complements everything we already kind of know. And so it's like interesting, but it's not like vital to much. So sorry, Mary. Like, I like you, but
that whole conversation where Mary is talking to Lyra and Will about why she left the church, and like the other piece of it is that she had decided she didn't really need to fall in love, and then she kind of just has this moment of like, maybe I do, like maybe I do want that, and you know, maybe there's no, I'm not, you know, really changing the world in any sort of way by choosing to deny myself this opportunity, hit me in like a different way this time around. This is like a whole personal tangent that I'm about to go on, but I ultimately pivoting back towards the Land of the Dead, because I want to talk about that a little bit more. The Mary stuff strikes me for a couple of reasons. One, when I first read the book, like that passage about like good and evil, that was for my 22-year-old self, the thing that was, I don't know, like really like life-altering and game-changing for me, because it was something that like put down in words was a thing that I felt and believed, but like given words. And so that's part of why it will just always be really important to me, independent of anything else about the story. It just lives in my feelings so strongly, partially because of that. Thing two is everything about the Land of the Dead, both like being there and then how it functions in the larger story, like narratively and metaphorically, is like my actual favorite part of it now. It's the thing that I think is most meaningful, because like really the major theme of the story is about like living your life to the fullest. I think that's probably the thing that is touched upon most repeatedly, because it's the point of the harpies that when you get to the land of the dead, you have to be able to tell them stories about what you did. And you know, that's the idea of like building the kingdom of heaven wherever you are, or whatever, et cetera, et cetera. It's all about, you know, like living a very full life. And so for me, this book has been like at various times in my life has been like a touchstone of like something that I can tether myself to because of how much I love that whole Land of the Dead storyline. I don't know. Anyway, all of that is to say that my love of Mary is like personal. I understand that not everybody feels the way that I do about Mary Malone.
I didn't dislike her.
But what I actually want to talk about though is the Land of the Dead. How did you guys feel about the Land of the Dead?
The Land of the Dead is very Greek mythology to me. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's literally just like picked up from Greek mythology and then put into this story. So like the harpies do a similar thing. Their whole job in Greek mythology is to like torment people, and that's what mm-hmm. they're doing in this story. It's just ghosts instead of like live people. And then how everyone is like just a shade of themselves is definitely Greek mythology, like the field of Asphodel, where people don't really remember who they are, which is like how the older ghosts in the Land of the Dead are. They don't remember their names. Like a lot of the children have forgotten their names. Yeah, so I liked that. And then I liked how Lyra and Will decided to change it. And it really rewarded. And yeah, how you were saying, like, live a fulfilling life and everything like that. And I think that that is just reinforced by the harpies in this story, because the harpies' job is to now guide the dead from, like, the Chiron-like boat that takes you to the Land of the Dead. And then take you to the exit so that you can be dissipated into the world and reunited with your demon. I do think it's interesting because, like, so far the harpies have just been, you know, sustaining themselves on the misery of people. And I feel like that's like a one-to-one with how the story really harps on living your life to the fullest and having like good memories to tell these harpies. Uh-huh. And to like focus on these good moments, and like the harpies are going to be sustained by these good memories instead of focusing on all the bad stuff that's happening. So I liked it. It's very Greek mythology, and I think that that's probably why I really enjoyed it.
To me, the Land of the Dead is like a great example of everything I like and don't like in this book. I think that I love the idea, as somebody who loves stories, like the idea of arriving to any sort of afterlife, like armed with your stories, and that being a passage to whatever else. Like, I love that idea. I love the idea that we owe it to ourselves and whatever like future version of ourselves to live life to the fullest, and to live like, this is the most important moment, right? Like, this is our heaven right now. Like, what we create, how we live our lives, that messaging, I love it. And I can see why that resounds, or like that lives so dearly in your heart, Nicole. I also think that a lot of like the Land of the Dead like has some open like why things that are, you know, like you talked about, like the harpies are there torturing people. Why? I don't know. Like, I think it's just part of like this larger, like the authority is bad, and we don't really get to see any more of that, because all that really matters for the sake of this story at this moment is that the authority is bad and he keeps dead people in the Land of the Dead with harpies to like bother them. And then like, I don't know, some of the messaging of like, you know, there is no afterlife. Heaven is what you create. It's the right now. But then the whole thing is that like they create this way that there is an afterlife, and you live on in everything around you, and you get to be reunited in the sense of like becoming one with nature and blades of grass and your demon. And like, so I don't know, some of the messaging gets a little bit confused to me, but that's probably because I grew up Christian, and there's so much of that, like that is, you know, very prevalent in my own thinking. Mm-hmm. That to see it here so strongly themed but not actually said in so many words, it leaves a lot of like open spaces where I'm like, wait, but what about that? So it distracts me from like the things that I really like, hey, come tell these harpy your stories and then you'll make it out of the land of the dead. Like, that's the portion that I really like. It's super interesting because the trailer dropped, which we mentioned, and there was a meme circulating around about how, like, you know, Philip Pullman created this, like, story that is rich in themes and talking about organized religion and dogma and all this stuff. And everybody's like, armored bears, armored bears. Which, yes, and that's so much how I feel. I think that that's why book one is my favorite. It's because it has so much more of, like, that fantasy adventure armored bears thing. And the more you get deeper into this world, the more, like, the themes become more prevalent. And what Philip Pullman believes is so evident on paper that if you don't 100% agree with him, it's a little chafing. It's a little jarring sometimes. And that's my experience sometimes in this third book. So mixed again.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this, I think, on the first episode, maybe, that, like, when I knew you were picking up the books for the first time, it was, like, really stressful and like, nerve-wracking for me. Because, you know, they're my favorite books. But also, I recognize I'm not, you know, deluded about the degree to which they have a very intense and strong philosophy. It just, like, happens to be one that I mostly jive with. So, like, you know, but, like, your experience with the book is definitely going to be colored by how you feel about that philosophy, and, like, inescapably so.
The funny thing is that, like, I will continue to reread these books because Will and Lyra forever.
So, okay. Will and Lyra forever. Can we talk about the ending? You were the, speaking of your first read.
Oh, yes.
Who first introduced me to the idea that, like, this was a version of it. And every time I read it, I'm like, I like tense up because I'm like, am I gonna understand it? Because I do understand this book differently every time. Like, I there are different things that I pick out. And I think I've talked before about how the first time that I read it, I, like, a lot of the anti-religious themes really went over my head. And, like, on first read, I was like, this book is kind of just anti a certain brand of, like, dogmatic organized religion. And it's only now that I get like how deep in its core it's opposed to religion. And I can't, you know, that, like, that's a, your mileage may vary. However, you were the one who first introduced me to the idea that a lot of people read the sort of the moment, the pebble in the stream moment, as Will and Lyra having sex. And yes. I just, what?
No, I don't even know how I came across this. I think after the first time that I read it, because it had, like, such a strong Adam and Eve parallel Garden of Eden kind of thing. I read it and I was like, did that just happen? Because it's a cut to black. All they do is kiss and it cuts to black. And then you join them again and it's like, everything has changed. They've grown up. And I don't personally read it this way, but I, like, read reviews or Googled it shortly after I read the book for the first time. And there are definitely people out there that are like, when Will and Lyra have sex in the garden. And I'm like, what?
Yeah. I mean, when I was reading it, I was like, did this just happen? Like, I definitely was like thinking that that was a possibility. I don't know if that happened or not. I know that they're like, she's like feeding him fruit and stuff, which Adam and Eve, she made him eat the fruit or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't. I feel like it could have been. I definitely see why people would think that, because it does fade to black and they're like kissing and making out, and then everything has changed and now they're adults and their demons are settling, like, for the first time because they're in love now. And after that specific scene, like, so much dust happens and, like, everything's gonna be okay now because they did some stuff in the forest kind of thing. So I definitely see where people could see that it's like a sex scene.
I don't think that it is. I think as I was reading it, because I had that in my mind also as I was, like, reading the whole thing, There were a couple moments that I think Philip Pullman is being, like, not weirdly, is what I'm saying, just kind of sexual in ways that I was like, what is he saying? But I think maybe the thing he's getting at is not so much like sex, plain and simple, but this entire idea of like pleasure, because I think Mary's whole thing is that, like, why should she deny herself any sort of pleasure kind of thing. And
yes,
again, that's so like wide open that that is open to interpretation of any sort. So you can use that to like say, yeah, that means sex. But right. To me, it does not. It does not necessarily. And I think that the kind of like love that Will and Lyra feel and the kind of like pleasure that they find in that love is to me and will always be age appropriate, and I'm not accepting any other answers.
yes, big agree. There's a part of me that's just like, yeah, I don't accept any other answers, first of all. And I don't know, it is also one of those things that I'm like, I don't understand why people want to, like, why do you want to read it that way? That's also my question.
I'm not saying I did. I'm just saying I can see how people think that.
Not you, Connor. The people, yes, other people.
The other people, yeah. To be clear, I'm not accusing you of anything.
I think he, like, purposely left it open so that every single person could, like, insert whatever they wanted into that scene.
I disagree. I was trying to find the slight changes that were made. The U.S. version cuts out a couple sentences and it, like, makes it more ambiguous. Basically, like, in the as it was originally published, it is, like, more explicit about the idea that what is happening is Lyra is experiencing physiologically physical attraction for the first time. As all of this is going on, she's like feeling things in her body, and it's like, oh, this is like weird and new and different. And something that is, you know, worth noting about both Will and Lyra is that they don't really have, Will has basically no friends his own age, and Lyra has no female friends her own age. And so neither one of them really had much exposure to the idea of like crushes, I think, you know, because of the very particular ways in which their experiences were sheltered. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's funny because the sort of, if I'm recalling correctly, the like physiological descriptions of like, oh my gosh, I am like attracted to this cute boy were cut because they were seen as sexualizing, but I think they actually make it worse by not, you know, being explicit about like, you know, like her heart's racing and you know, whatever else it was that she's feeling in response to that. So I don't know. I don't think it's ambiguous, but like, whatever. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe somebody's going to come to me on Twitter and be like, no, here's an interview in which Philip Pullman says they were definitely having sex. I don't know. I also don't really give a shit what Philip Pullman has to say. So as far as I'm concerned, there's no sex here. And I don't really understand the ambiguity of it, but I don't know. That's just me.
This is kind of pitches like the second fall of man, almost like, you know, again, mirroring Adam and Eve. But when Adam and Eve, like that whole story, their fall, the original sin was not sexual at all. It wasn't sex. It was gaining knowledge, basically, knowledge right. of good and evil. So I think that in order to like look at this and say, well, now they're having sex, I think what he was trying to do there is saying that they gained a certain kind of knowledge. And that's the whole like theme that he's going for, is that you gain a certain kind of knowledge when you move into, you know, young adulthood. And that is what starts to attract dust. And it's that curiosity, that need to like know things that, and you know, he puts the organized religion or the magisterium or whatever at the opposite of that. And in so many words in this book, he's like, he calls it stupidity, basically, to subscribe to other people's rules or whatnot and not like seek out your own, you know, wisdom or be curious or whatever. So I think that people mistake probably this idea of this being a fall for something sexual, which I don't think is even a thing or like a message that Philip Pullman would give. But I think what's happening in that moment is what Nicole is talking about. And it's just more of like an awareness, an opening of the eyes of a, oh, cute boy, and being more aware of like her attraction, her body or whatever else.
That is a really interesting point, though, that like the degree to which the, you know, like really intense anti-religious messaging also probably feeds into that. So it's like, especially in particular context, I guess I can only speak to like an American context, but I can for sure see why an American audience in particular would be like, oh, well, whatever it is that they're doing, the church doesn't want them to do it, so it must be sex, you know, like making those sorts of steps. Like I can see how that would feed into this reading of it. in part because you cannot subtract all of the cultural context from which you are reading a thing. So this is me, like, you know, walking back my chastising a little bit of other people finding this there. I mean, I still think you're wrong, but I can understand a little bit more of why you would read that because of the ways in which you have been primed by all of your own cultural context and by all of the book's very intense anti-religious messaging leading up to that moment.
I don't want to end on the note of whether or not these two kids had sex. we're like running out of time here. But I just want to, like, my final little piece that I wanted to add. This book is, like, super heartbreaking for the end. I always think that it's super tragic in a way, even though it tries to give you this hope of, like, them living out their separate full lives, but still always remembering each other. I'm still like, boo, sad. But another thing that made me surprisingly, and I don't even have a real explanation for this, but it just made me really sad that Will and Lee Scoresby didn't know each other very well. I don't know why that stood out to me on this read, but he says a couple times, like, oh, Lee Scoresby, I never knew him that well. And I'm just like, they would be so great together. And
they would have been such great friends.
Uh-huh. And I'm sad that never happened.
I will say the one level on which I do appreciate the, like, sad ending, and this is, like, a thing sort of separate from the book, going back to this idea of, you know, the cultural context in which you are consuming a thing, the, like, these two children and their first love is not, like, actually, yes, forever.
Right.
You know, like, a pervasive theme in YA is, like, you know, your high school boyfriend is your forever. And, like, no, you know, you're 12, 13, 13 years old. Like, trust me, this isn't it for you. Like, you have your whole life ahead of you.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I do. I think it is sad in the moment because, like, obviously they first love and everything like that, and it, like, almost immediately gets snatched away.
Right, yeah.
I think that's, like, the worst part about it, because they could have been together for, like, two more months and then it would have been calling it quits because
they're 13.
They're 12. Yeah.
I liked that. I mean, it is sad, but I still think that they probably did go ahead and lead completely, like, normal lives. I don't know if the sequel series has anything to do with this original series, and if we get any answers on that.
I have no idea. I have never actually, I own the other books. There's Lyra's Oxford is, I think, her as, like, a teenager. I think the premise, it's her, it's like a novella, and that's her as a teenager while she's, like, you know, training to read the alethiometer or something. I'm not really sure. I have no idea. There's birds involved. I know because somebody sent me a picture of the French cover, and the French title is, like, Lyra and the Birds. But it's otherwise the same cover. So I was like, okay, I know what this is. I have no idea what it's about. And then The Book of Dust, I also have never read, because this is my jam. This is like me and Veronica Mars, too, where I've seen all three seasons a million times, but never watched the movie, read the book, purchased all the shit, but like, nope, it stopped there. It's like fixed in my memory at a certain point. And every time I think about going forward, I'm like, well, I could just go back and do it all over again instead.
It speaks to me on such a deep level. But I just Googled it, and it's a prequel. So it takes place 12 years before The Golden Compass, and it tells the story of how Lyra ended up at Oxford.
Oh, that's right. I do. Yes. I vaguely remember reading that probably in the description when I purchased it.
Never to be read again. And on that note, thank you to Connor for joining us not only this week, but through our journey through his Dark Materials. Thank you all for listening. We'd love to hear all of your thoughts on The Amber Spyglass. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on snarksquad.com. You can also sign up to join our community on Patreon at patreon.com/snarksquad. There you can find polls, live hangouts, and other bonus content. You can also find us on Twitter at snark_squad. You can find me at My Name is Marines.
I am at Sweeney Says.
And I am at Connor Bookinet.
Thank you, as always, to Stefan Chin for the theme music that is playing us out right now. We'll be back in your feed next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.